So I want to talk and follow up from both the February 1st retreat and what we explored last week, and explore in a way also related to the guided meditation, some about the really about the understanding of awakening that we get from the historical Buddha, and then ways to practice with the core teachings on awakening in daily life, so that this isn't simply a remote teaching or an unobtainable level of awareness, but that this is actually something that can be very practical for us. So in a way, this could be said to be, to some extent, demystifying awakening, making it something that we are cultivating in our practice. So, just a little bit of review. Again, the Buddha was known as the one who was awake. And it's interesting that the term woke has become so politicized, which is really, I mean, you think about it, that's really saying, let's be awake. But for the powers that be at the current time, that's a bad thing. And, you know, most of you know that the term woke came from, I don't know if I mentioned this last time, but it came from the African American tradition and was, I think, first expressed in a public form by the musician Leadbelly in his song about the Scottsboro Boys, I think 1938. And he said, we have to stay woke. So, any case, that's a little contemporary reference. But especially we looked at last time and in the day long, the kind of the most fundamental meaning of dukkha. You know, remember the whole aim of the teachings of the Buddha is to end dukkha. But it can be quite a confusing teaching, for reasons that I gave last week and at the day long, which is because the Buddha, in the discourses that we have, which were not, you know, all sorts of, you know, edited in some fundamental way, they were just collected, that the Buddha had at least four different meanings of dukkha, only one of which makes sense of the meaning of the end of dukkha. And I interpret that meaning as reactivity. You know, the sense of grasping after the pleasant and in a compulsive or habitual, often automatic and relatively unconscious way, pushing away the unpleasant. And I gave the qualification of that teaching, I think, both when I brought it up, but also, if I remember right, in a response to a question from Liz, that it's also the problem is not the pleasant or the unpleasant. The problem is the habitual, automatic, unconscious way that we grasp after the pleasant or push away the unpleasant. That what we want to do is often to skillfully go for what is pleasant or what is good, and want to skillfully go against what is unpleasant, painful, not good. So we want to skillfully act, for example, against injustice. We want to skillfully address the pain in our bodies and so forth. So the core meaning of dukkha has to do with the unconscious, habitual, automatic or relatively unconscious nature. That's really, really crucial. And again, the most common sense of dukkha in the text and in the way people teach is dukkha is translated as suffering. And unless we give a technical definition of suffering, you know, as something like reactivity, which some people do, and I used to do that, unless we do that, if suffering is simply equivalent, as it was in the teachings, in this first sense of dukkha, If it's simply equivalent to pain, what's painful or unpleasant, then as long as we're alive, there's no end to that. That's part of human experience. But there can be an end to reactivity. And so that's what we looked at last time and in the day long. And then we also looked quite a bit at the teachings about awakening as the going beyond the ordinary constructions of experience. There's a text which I think I quoted last time where the Buddha is talking about really the nature of awakening, the nature of nirvana or nibbana. And he talks about it as being about the signless, the boundless, and the all-luminous. And so, in particular, when the Buddha uses the word sign, he's really talking about a concept related to an object, the way that we construct the world by giving names to the various objects, giving concepts to them. And increasingly, in our perception, seeing a particular field of experience and naming it as an object. And that helps us get around the world, helps us decide what we want to go shopping for, helps us meet a lot of our needs. But the Buddha said that there's something about the use of what he called signs, we could talk about them as concepts, that is problematic. That in a way we're constructing experience. And I think last time we looked to the way that most of us have had experiences, sometimes on retreats or in meditating, where we're able to go beyond ordinary concepts and experience, let's say, what we call a sunset, or what we call a tree, without using those labels. And when I asked for a show of hands, almost everyone could point to those experiences. And what the Buddha is pointing to is the capacity of going beyond the different signs, the different concepts of our experience. For the Buddha, there is a tendency when we use concepts and signs to assume permanence. So the Buddha thought that concepts and signs confuse us. They make us think that things are permanent. We also set up a way of knowing in which we have a self or subject knowing the world. They set up a division between the knower and the known, the subject and the object. Again, useful in many ways in daily experience, but the capacity of awakening is to be able to go beyond those constructions. And in our guided meditation, we looked at a variety of ways to go beyond the ordinary constructions of experience. We looked first at the ways that we have very commonly a sense of pleasant or unpleasant or neutral with different moments of experience and could be related to different parts of our experience. And on the basis of that, there can be the reactivity. Again, one of the ways that we construct experience, that there's a construction very much related to a sense of self. And so we looked into that, and that, in terms of our daily life practice, is a fundamental way that we move forward, as it were. In terms of awakening, we see more clearly reactivity. We see more clearly when there's a strong sense of self. And we also started to look at how we can have a sense of the impermanence of experience and can see increasingly become able to go beyond seeing permanent objects, that we can be with impermanence, also a way of deconstructing the usual permanence of things. And then in the last part of the guided meditation, we started to explore the way that it's possible in choiceless awareness to go first beyond the ordinary sense of self, choosing what to focus on, and just be with the flow of experience, even as we may be naming what we're experiencing an experience, noticing, oh, there's a thought. Oh, this is very much what we often do in our mindfulness practice. Oh, there's a thought. Oh, there's an emotion. Oh, there's this body sensation. Oh, there's this, there's that. And that can be a more advanced form of mindfulness practice, just noticing without choosing what to focus on. And then a more advanced form of what I've called choiceless awareness is when we can, and this takes a fair level of concentration, is when we can start to be with the flow of experience without conceptualizing and go beyond concepts, go beyond, in the Buddha's language, go beyond the sign, go beyond ordinary perception. And at first we may just want to do this for a few minutes at a time and see if we can do that again. It's dependent on a pretty good level of concentration, but we can actually start to be with the flow of experience without concepts and start experiencing that, at least for brief periods, in our meditation, going beyond some of these ordinary constructions. The Buddha says at one point, when we look most deeply, perception is like a mirage. And that when we're not seeing the signs, we're not engaged in ordinary perception. In fact, in some of the passages, the Buddha said that all of perception is actually based on wanting and not wanting. We see things, we look for things. There's sometimes a subtle level of wanting and not wanting, but that we actually are dependent for all of perception on that wanting and not wanting. And so the Buddha said that awakening goes beyond these ordinary constructions. And we could also, I haven't mentioned and we didn't explore experientially the constructions of time and space, but we could also talk about the potential of going beyond ordinary experiences of time and space. So this is a tall order, isn't it? Awakening, going beyond the ordinary constructions of perception, going beyond reactivity, the ordinary sense of self, the use of ordinary concepts, time and space. So why do that? Well, the promise is that this brings the deepest happiness and the deepest wisdom, right? Or that's the finding, that it frees us from being bound to reactivity. And that it's equivalent to going beyond constructions, at least for a short time, at least tasting awakening. And so the Buddha did talk about awakening as touching the signless, going beyond. You know, the Venerable Anālayo has a book which goes into more detail on this. I think I mentioned it at the day long and maybe last time. It's called The Signless and the Deathless. If you want a fuller account of this with a lot of quotations. And he says that awakening is a complete stepping out of the way the mind usually constructs experience. A complete stepping out of the way the mind usually constructs experience. And then I should say that after their moments of awakening, we can actually come back and engage in ordinary experience, in ordinary talk with people. The Buddha certainly did that. But there's a way that we are doing so with a knowledge that we're beyond we're both beyond ordinary experience and also engaging in ordinary, in a way with ordinary experience, but we're not taking it seriously in the same way that we did prior to awakening. Radical statement by the Buddha, there's no reaching of the end of dukkha without reaching the end of the world. I think he would mean the end of the ordinary world of experience. From the Buddha, on seeing a form, one does not grasp its sign, and the mind conforms to right mindfulness. Craving will not defile the mind, and the bondage of attachment also will not arise, not giving rise to cravings. Thoughts of desire, ill will, and harm will be unable to afflict the mind, diminishing what fosters a host of afflictions, one gradually draws close to nirvana. That's from the Buddha. This is what's carried down to us from the tradition. And the Thai forest tradition, which has influenced many of us, had a little different language of talking about it, but it was the same aim to reach this quality of awakening. Achan Cha called awakening touching the old mind. He said, we are practicing to reach the mind, the old mind, this original mind, and probably in the translation we could probably say mind and heart. This original mind and heart are unconditioned. There's no good or bad, long or short, black or white. It's unwavering. It is tranquil. Practice really means searching to find our way back to the original state, the old thing. It is finding our old home, the original mind and heart that do not waver and change following various phenomena, by nature perfectly peaceful, already within us. So, how do we cultivate awakening in daily life? And I could add the question, how does this resonate with us? I'll come back to that. And so, multiple ways of practicing. We could do something. We have the guided meditation from today. We could work with that and regularly work with going beyond constructions at our own pace, not rushing it. We can practice to notice moments of reactivity, a very helpful daily life practice. Set the intention in the morning. Let me notice moments of reactivity. If you notice one after a conversation, or I don't know, these days, reading the newspaper or hearing the news, notice reactivity, bring mindfulness to it. Again, remembering that reactivity can carry discernment, that I can be negatively reactive towards something, as in the case when I'm negatively reactive towards injustice. And as we explored, I think it was last week and also at the day long, reactivity often carries insight or discernment, and we want to find a way to disentangle the reactivity from the insight. Again, a crucial qualifier to all of this. So we can notice reactivity, study it, ask what's valuable in my reactivity? How can I separate it from the reactivity? We could practice with impermanence, and maybe, all of these could be things that we do or practices that we do for a period of time. We can practice for a month, noticing reactivity. Set the intention to notice reactivity two or three times a day. If you have the capacity to pause, study reactivity when it occurs. Do that over and over again. Practice with impermanence, noticing impermanence. Do that in your meditation. Sometimes just pause and notice things changing. It's not a dramatic meditation, but over time, something sinks in. practicing noticing when there's a strong sense of self. And again, bring mindfulness to it. You know, it's what I call working with a fixed sense of self. Do that in your meditation. Notice that during the day when there's a very strong sense of self. Again, not necessarily just a problem. There can be something valuable there, but we want to be mindful and disentangle what's valuable or discerning from the reactivity. We can practice going beyond ordinary time. Can we be sometimes just in the moment without the ordinary sense of time? I didn't bring up time in the guided practice, but that's another way of going beyond ordinary constructions of experience. Another way of working with this is inspired by something I learned from the Tibetan tradition. In the Tibetan tradition, there's a practice called mixing practice, or in one of the Tibetan traditions, I learned this from the Bon tradition, where one goes into an awakened state and, you know, in meditation, and then from that relatively awakened place, brings it into ordinary experience. And so they would be somewhat stable, the monks or practitioners or nuns would be somewhat stable with awakening, and then they'd say, let me go into actions of body, speech, and mind. And so some of it's actually humorous. They would be in awakened state and then try to see if they could keep the sense of being beyond constructions in walking and just walking around. They also would do it with unskillful forms of body, speech, and mind. So they would be grounded in an awakened state and then be with another person and start punching that person and try to keep awakened state. That's what I learned in this advanced Tibetan practice, punching other people and trying to keep awake. Okay, I'm not sure if we'll pass that on in the West, but anyway, that was same thing with skillful speech and unskillful speech. So one can be in a relatively awakened state beyond constructions, at least for a little while, and then bring it into ordinary experience and try that. And see if you can be in a place without concepts, and see if you can go there several times a day, hang out there, be with a tree, what we call a tree, or again, the sunset. See if you can be with the flowers and the trees, and then drop concepts. Doing that many times a day will advance awakening. And so I want to close just by asking the question, in addition to identifying these ways of practicing, how is holding the framework of awakening helpful or inspiring for you? Just see what comes to you. Does the framework of awakening, is it helpful, inspiring, identifying these specific practices? Do you find bringing in the concept of awakening and the teachings on awakening challenging or hard or maybe not resonating with you? Why is that, do you sense? What's challenging for you about bringing awakening into daily life? Or into your meditation as well? And for me, it's especially having some continuity of awakened awareness in the flow of daily life. When I'm on retreat, I can be pretty awake. Daily life has its challenges, and that's really, personally, that's my cutting edge. So let me stop there. Let me see if I have an inspiring quotation. Well, maybe I'll quote from the Buddha. I have taught dukkha and the end of dukkha. I teach the signless, I teach the boundless, I teach the all luminous. So let me finish there and just invite us to sit quietly for a few moments. See what may have resonated, see where there might be a question or a sharing. Could be a question about the guided meditation or the talk, which were quite related. So good. Let's have a time now to share and explore.
People have their
Okay.
hands up,
Eva,
Donald.
what's that?
People have their hands up.
I'm aware of that. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Let's go to Vita and then Mary.
Thank you. I don't know why, but just a little bit more being with something without concepts, like trees or flowers. Can you just say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it's partly one way of talking about it, and all the talking is using concepts to talk about going beyond concepts. So I appreciate the irony. One way of talking about it, and I think we probably have experienced this, I think most of us have experienced this, is that what's the difference between being with what we call a tree? And saying tree and having tree come through our mind and just being with the raw sense data, you know, the colors, the forms, without having any conceptualization going on in the mind. So there are forms out there, there are colors, there's what we could call sense data. And so going beyond concepts with what we call a tree would be being with all the forms, colors, shapes, and so forth, letting them be there in our raw experience, but not using a concept about them, maybe not even using a concept about the shape or the color, but just being, as it were, beyond using concepts, which I think all of us experience at times. Does that help, Vita?
Very much. Yes, absolutely. I just
And
want to say
you.
one other quick thing. I'm not quite sure I understand all of this, but it feels like a more doable path to awakening.
Yeah, all I think you're right. I mean, we can go beyond concepts. It's demystifying awakening to some extent. You know, talking in the way that I've spoken tonight, in my experience, isn't very commonly done in Dharma talks, right? And it can, I think, demystify awakening. It's still profound to go beyond ordinary construction experience is not a small thing, right? But it can demystify it and can actually point out that we actually do this even non-intentionally in our experience at time when we're really in the wilds and in awe of what's around us. Often the mind gets quiet and we're not conceptualizing. How many can relate to that? You know, that's a very common experience. That's an awakened moment, right? And so awakening is something that we notice, but here we are deliberately training with awakening. Again, we have the capacity, even as we stabilize an awakening, we have the capacity to be with ordinary concepts and be in the ordinary world of concepts. The Buddha certainly was in that world. Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Vita. So Mary and Liz and then Barbara.
So,
I'm back to the response of reactivity when one reads something in the news.
Yeah.
And it was very helpful for me to hear you talk about disentangling the pieces in it that are really related to injustice,
Yeah.
which I feel like that really helps me kind of calm down a bit, you know? But so I experience this intense reactivity, and like just my whole body gets like the but you know the gut is just full of heat and anger when I
Right.
read some of these things, and I haven't been able to find a way to respond. You know, I haven't been able to come up
Right.
with an appropriate response. It just I'm stuck in reactivity, but
Yeah.
disentangling helps. But as I was thinking about it, perhaps sending compassion even to the people who've been humiliated.
Yeah.
This is what I was reading about with some people who've been terribly humiliated, and which I find really terrible. Being able just for me, I finally came up with an idea of how I can. Some way I can calm my reactivity.
Yeah, I think there's a lot there, and we could go on for the next hour about different aspects of all this. But I think the heart of spiritually grounded activism is the transformation of reactivity. And where activists don't transform the reactivity, it, I would argue, isn't very skillful. And a large amount of it, activists turn their reactivity against their fellow activists. That's very, very common. When I did a workshop at a conference on called Spiritual Activism, and I was giving a workshop on what does training for spiritual activists look like, I asked them first, what's the major problem that you deal with? And they basically said, we all turn on each other. You know, that was most common. And I think that's from not having the tools to transform reactivity. You know, and we can do that with our mindfulness. I think bringing in the compassion is really, really crucial. And separating the reactivity from the insight or the discernment and knowing that that's going to be there. So, you know, we don't squash the reactivity, we transform it. And then we use, you know, the basic formula is, we learn how to separate through mindfulness, compassion, other practices. We separate out the reactivity from the discernment, which could be discernment about something wrong, unjust, unjust, unethical. And we use the discernment as the basis for compassionate action. That's the formula. Easier said than done, but that's what we can do. And so it can be really helpful to do the transformative practice of the reactivity. But like you say, to, you know, and maybe last thing to say is that so many people have very similar states these days and don't know how to respond. You know, Angela Sarian said, action alleviates anxiety. And I think very much bringing compassion to people who are going through a difficult time, all the civil servants and so forth. Very, very crucial. Again, a lot more could be said there, but maybe that's a starting point. Liz and then Barbara.
Not sure I can really grasp this to express it, but I just did a workshop with Allison Teel on resourcing, and she says there is thought, sensation, and emotion in every those three, thought, sensation, and emotion in every reaction. She doesn't use the word reaction, but I'm doing that. And that goes back to dependent origination. When I lived in the monastery, I took a test on dependent origination and I passed, but I never understood it from then on. So the essence of what you're saying is even though I'll get into this subtlety, this thought sensation and emotion, which creates a field of experience. But even with all that subtlety, you have a reaction. You stop, pause, the famous word pause. I want to present it, pause. I'm going to make a big sign. You know you're going to have a reaction. It's automatic. Having a reaction is automatic.
Liz, remember that distinction that I made last week when you asked the question? Reactivity, we use the word reaction in different ways.
Yes.
I'm distinguishing between reactivity and what occurs in our experience, like what
Right.
you call the reaction.
I understand that. But
Those
we
aren't the
first
same.
have, yeah, we first have to understand there's a reaction. When we understand there's a reaction, we can pause before there's reactivity.
Yeah, sometimes there's reactivity right away. Again,
Yes.
I don't use the word reaction because of possible confusion with reactivity, but basically it's saying that with all of our experience, we experience something. Sometimes there's no reaction. Sometimes I notice the sunset, and I just notice the sunset. There's not necessarily a reaction there. So I think that. So I'm not sure how you're using the word reaction, but
And what I'm saying is emotion or thought or sensation, an immediate dependent origination. I think the first thing is formation. Isn't there an immediate reaction based on experience? No, I don't know.
the basic formula we looked at in the day-long sum. It may have been before you came. Basically, there is contact through one of the senses, then
Yes.
feeling tone. And then, if there's ignorance and habitual patterns, there is wanting and then grasping. And if there, with the pleasant and not wanting and pushing away with the unpleasant. And if there's wisdom, an awakened state, then there's just mindfulness of what's happening. In that sense, there's not a reaction. There's just mindfulness.
That's a goal. I like that. For
And the mindfulness, but then if there's a need for a response, it will be more skillful rather than go into reactivity. So, like I said, it's often very skillful to go for the pleasant and push away the unpleasant, but one can do it skillfully without reactivity.
okay, for me right now, I have to remember that I'm going to have a reaction and wait, hopefully, before I do enough or reactive, before I act.
Yeah,
To
again, in
know.
some situations there may be a reaction, some there might not be.
Okay.
Yeah.
By the way, Sylvia Boorstein has this acronym, WAIT. Why am I talking? Which I'm going to use right now.
Right.
Is there an acronym for reactivity? I don't think so.
To notice reactivity?
Yeah. I don't think there was one. Well,
I haven't made one up, but I just say set the intention to notice reactivity.
right.
Okay.
Definitely.
Thanks,
Thank
Liz.
you.
Last one, Barbara, please.
I was just wondering what the relationship is. I think maybe I know, but the relationship between the experience of emptiness and the experience of signlessness. And is it we talking emptiness being empty of concept? Would that be a way of saying it? Or, but the whole
Yeah.
idea, very often I have this experience of emptiness when I'm having the feeling, the experience of signlessness.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they're very close. That again, emptiness is used in little different ways in the different Buddhist traditions. So in Mahayana, it's basically about na not taking anything as solidly there. So, in other words, it's not taking the concept seriously, and coming back to it's very close to coming back to that raw experience before there's conceptualization. That's very much what the experience of emptiness is like. So I didn't use that word, but some of us may have experienced in the guided meditation when the instruction was just be with the raw sense data. If we were really being just with the raw sense data, that could be called an experience of emptiness. It means empty, really empty of anything solid is what it means, or solid or permanent. Yeah. But I think you're right to make the connection between what we were exploring and the understanding of emptiness. I think that's right.
Yeah, I almost feel it sometimes even goes beyond that sense of sense data, which also is a concept, that there's something even behind all that,
Yeah.
or nothing behind it. That's emptiness.
Emptiness is especially about the experiencing without conceptualization or without taking anything as really there in some, substantial way. Like a thing being there. It's really partly going beyond ordinary conceptualization. Yeah, so very closely related to what we've been exploring. I think we're getting close to the time. I saw Zoe, you had your hand up. What do you think, folks? Mary, should we take one more, or should we get to our closing now? Anyone have a? Because I
Quick
know
one
we're
should be fine.
okay. Please, Zoe, last one. Yeah.
So, on the theme of reactivity, if you feel a reaction in your body, say you witness something that you feel is injustice, and this heat, this anger arises in the body, and you're aware that you feel angry,
Yeah.
but you don't necessarily respond verbally or in some fashion, is that still reactivity? If you're feeling this sense of anger or injustice in the body.
Not necessarily. Again, the hallmark of reactivity is that there's some grasping or pushing away in a kind of habitual or compulsive way. So I can just be experiencing anger in my emotions, in my body, and so forth. And if I'm just letting it flow, there's no reactivity. If I'm just letting it flow and my thoughts are not going into reactivity and association with it, then there's not reactivity. So anger can totally exist, and strong experiences in the body can totally exist without reactivity. It's actually one of the ways that we can really transform reactivity. It's by, for example, if there's a lot of anger about injustice, we can be with the anger, watch the reactivity come through in thoughts, and why did they do that? And then increasingly, actually grounding in body and emotions is a way that I can increasingly be with the anger. And experientially, if I hang out enough with the anger, it actually goes, and I've experienced this, and I think I've talked about it at times, it can go into sadness and even go into beneath anger is typically sadness and even love. And so what if I'm an activist, I get really, really angry, but I'm mindful enough of the anger, I hang out with it and watch it over time. It may take a while. But I notice it turning into sadness and grief, and then the sadness and grief turning into love. If I go through that internal process, then I can act coming in relation to the injustice coming out of love, which is, of course, what people like Dr. King and others recommended, that the whole movement be based on love. And he said that at the center of our movement is the transformation of anger. So maybe something like the process I just mentioned, not easy. And sometimes we have to be with it for quite a while and develop skill. But that, yeah, the presence of anger by itself without thoughts that express reactivity is not necessarily reactivity. Yeah.
Thank you.
Very, very helpful to look into that. Thank you.